Do keep that open. And I want to describe to you a particular community. This is a real community of people who are passionate about what they believe in. They're distinctive from the world around. They believe in a truth that they want other people to know and believe in. And they're prepared to go to prison for this truth. This community, while distinctive, is also very attractive. They try and love each other. They try and provide for each other. They show a joy in themselves because they're working towards a better world. And because of all this, this community is a growing community as more and more people join them. I wonder who I'm talking about. You may think I'm talking about the Christian community, the church. After all, everything I've said there, we would want to be true of ourselves, wouldn't we? But in fact, I'm talking about this community. Anyone know this? We live in Bristol. This is the Extinction Rebellion Handbook. And that's the community that I'm talking about. I've got a friend who's part of Extinction Rebellion. She gave me this handbook. She always carries around a spare handbook to give to people who might want to read it. I was one of those people that she gave it to. And as I've read the book and I've watched people around, whether close by or on the news, I've been more and more impressed. I don't agree with them on a number of things, but I'm very impressed by them. I'm impressed by their commitment to what they believe, by their willingness to sacrifice a life of comfort and consumerism for a life of self-denial, by their willingness to go to prison for what they believe in, for the world that they are working towards, and by their bold challenge to the rest of us to join them, to work for this world, this better world that they want. They are a real counterculture, a community that is distinctive to the world around them. Now, Christians are supposed to be that counterculture, aren't they? As Peter writes in his first letter, we are a holy nation. We've been called out of darkness into his wonderful light, out of the world into his kingdom. And so he urges the Christians he's writing to, who are foreigners and exiles, who are foreign to this world, to live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. This term on our Sunday evenings, we're working through the Beatitudes, the start of the Sermon on the Mount. It's a sermon early on in Matthew's gospel where Jesus gives his clearest teaching on what kingdom life is going to look like, what his new community is looking like and should look like. And these Beatitudes are the introduction to that sermon. So have a look at them, why don't you? It's on page 968 in our Blue Church Bibles, Matthew 5, verses 3 to 12. Have a look at those Beatitudes and see how countercultural they are. If you were going to give a set of values to sum up our society today, would they be these values? Or would they be the opposite of these? I think if you're going to describe values that describe our world today, they'd be the opposite of these ones. It wouldn't be blessed are the poor in spirit, but blessed are those who are proud of what they achieved because they'll achieve more. It wouldn't be blessed are those who mourn, but blessed are those who have a good time, because that's the most important thing to do in our world. It wouldn't be blessed are the meek, but blessed are those who put themselves first, for they will get what they want and deserve. I could go on, couldn't I? So as we come to these Beatitudes, how are we going to read them? How should we read them? Well, I think there are probably two dangers as we come to read them. The first danger is to think that they are impossible. Surely no one can live like this. No one can have a righteousness that exceeds that of the Pharisees. And it's impractical for a society to live like this. Turn the other cheek, walk an extra mile. A society can't live like that. Love your enemies. Come on. It's impractical. It's unrealistic. The first danger is that we think that they're impossible, and so we dumb them down to something that is more doable. Jesus didn't quite say that. He said this. We can do this. The second danger is that we think they are possible, that we can do them. Maybe like Leo Tolstoy, as he wrote in his book Resurrection, that this is what our society needs. Maybe ignore some parts of the Bible, but this, what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, this, if we all live like this, what kind of world could we build? Or maybe we think that as Christians, this is the pass mark to join Jesus' kingdom. Now, some of them might look quite hard, but come on, let's try. Let's try and do them, and we can join Jesus' kingdom. So two dangers as we come to read them. First, that we think that they're impossible, and so we dumb them down to make them doable. Second, we think that they are possible, that we can do them in our own strength. The truth is that we can do them, but only if we're already in Jesus' kingdom. Only if we've been born again and become a new creation. Only if we've repented and trusted in Jesus, our King. Have a look at Matthew 4, verse 17. From that time on, Jesus began to preach, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near." Jesus is just beginning his ministry, and we see that he's come to call people to repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near. So his Sermon on the Mount, which follows a few verses later this, is for those who repent and enter the kingdom. He's speaking in chapter 5 to those who are his disciples. See that? Chapter 5, verse 1. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. And then he tells them what kingdom life must look like, what it will look like, what people who've been transformed by Jesus, how they'll begin to live. This sermon is possible for Christians. And not just a select few Christians, but for every Christian. But this sermon is only possible for Christians. And no one else. For those who've been born into this kingdom, who are already in it, and who are becoming more like this through the Spirit who works in them. That's why he starts with this first beatitude. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Those who are poor in spirit, those who realize that they are spiritually poor, that they are spiritually bankrupt. In other words, the kingdom of heaven belongs to those who know that they don't deserve it. And let's look at two examples from the Bible. One from the Old Testament, one from the New Testament. So first, Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 6. There is no PowerPoint, so you will be helped if you turn to it. Isaiah 6, this is page 691. It's a passage you may know already, in which we see the prophet Isaiah, who's given a vision of God. And let's see how he responds to God. Isaiah chapter 6, page 691. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord, high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces. With two they covered their feet. With two they were flying. They were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook as the temple, and the temple was filled with smoke. How does Isaiah respond coming face to face with the living God? Verse 5. "Woe to me," I cried. "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Isaiah knows that he's spiritually poor. He sees God and he sees himself and he knows himself to be spiritually bankrupt, ruined in his words. He's got nothing to offer him, nothing on which he can stand before this God before him. When we come to the New Testament, we find a similar example in Luke's gospel. Luke records this parable that Jesus told about two men who go into the temple. Luke chapter 18, this is on page 1052. Luke chapter 18, verse 9. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. Robbers, evildoers, adulterers, even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. The Pharisee, he's the opposite of spiritually poor, isn't he? He stands before God, he preens himself, showing off his feathers. As far as he's concerned, God is almost lucky to have him on his side. Have a look at the tax collector, verse 13. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Tax collector stands before God, and in words similar to Isaiah's, he cries out for the only thing that he can ask of God, mercy. If God were to give him what he deserves, he'd be blown away. He knows it will only be because of God's mercy that he's got any chance of standing in God's presence. What's the result? Verse 14, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. That's the tax collector, went home justified, right before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humble, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Jesus says it's those who humble themselves, who know their own spiritual poverty, their bankruptcy before God, who receive mercy. Isaiah was the same. Verse 6 of chapter 6 of Isaiah. Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, see, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, your sin atoned for. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Friends, it's easy for us to read these passages and agree with them. And yet we can act like the Pharisee, can't we? We come to know God. We come to God receiving his mercy, knowing his mercy. But then over time, we begin to grow in our knowledge of God. Other people look to us. They ask questions of us about Jesus. And bit by bit, we stop looking to Jesus for mercy and we trust in ourselves, like that Pharisee. Like the Pharisee who looks down on the tax collector, we can look down on others. Maybe they can't explain the gospel as well as us. Maybe their life is more obviously sinful than ours. So at the start of his sermon, Jesus wants us to know those who belong in his kingdom are those who know they don't belong in his kingdom. That those who will be able to live the kingdom life that he's about to explain and illustrate over the next 2-3 chapters are those who run to Christ for help because they know that they can't do it. As Matthew wrote his gospel, he'd have remembered his own calling by Jesus. He was a tax collector, wasn't he? Matthew 9, this is page 973. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told me, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Jesus came for the sinners, for those who know that they are sinners. While those who think that they're righteous, the spiritually rich, are left outside his kingdom. So let me ask you now, at the start of this new year, do you realize your spiritual bankruptcy? If you do, and you've thrown yourself on the mercy of King Jesus, then to you belongs the kingdom of heaven. And you'll be a person who mourns because you know your own sin. You'll be a person who is meek, because who are you to put yourself forward? You will hunger and thirst for righteousness because you know in and of yourself you have no righteousness. You will know the blessing of life in this kingdom. Now, some commentators want to translate the word blessed, happy. That's probably not the best way to translate it, because happiness in our language is something that goes up and down. It's something that we feel. Sometimes happy, sometimes not happy. This is not about how we feel, but about how God thinks and feels about us. That's what is important. And for those who run to Christ, trusting in him, God puts his stamp of approval on them. His permanent smile looking over them. He blesses them. The Extinction Rebellion community are building a community which offers some hope based on some truth. But don't we have something a million times better? Professor Jem Bendel writes in the Extinction Rebellion Handbook, "I cannot honestly hope for a better future, so instead I'm hoping for a better present." We have a hope for a better future that is sure and certain, because our Creator, Sovereign God, who stepped into history as a man, will make sure of it. He's offered his own life to pay the ransom for it. He's risen from the grave to resurrection life, to triumphantly declare it. And this new community will be filled with people who live like this. A Christian counterculture, as John Stott describes it. Now, are we going to be this Christian counterculture? Only as we look at God and then see how spiritually poor we are, and then run to Christ.